The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Members, we have a full plate today, and what discussion on this topic we don't finish today, we will continue on Thursday. So for those of you in the public who are here to testify on the three bills, on Senate File 685, Senate File 279, and on Thursday we're going to pick up Senator Ortman's bill on the same issue, along with a couple of other bills. So my goal is that we will get through the reports today, and if we have an opportunity, we want to try to lay out sort of the mechanics of what these two bills are about and follow it through with Senator Ortman's bill on Thursday. We will try to get to testifiers. Now, if you're here from out of town or from far away, and it will be difficult for you to be back, like really difficult for you to be back on Thursday, we want to give you the courtesy of testifying and not make it difficult. So Regina Garza is over here. Raise your hand, Regina. Come stand over there at the gate, signal to her, and let her know. And we will try to reserve, about 10, 15, 20 minutes at the end, depending on how many people, to let the public give us your comments. But what we want to do is, this is an area that is very critical. The committee wants to do good work in this area. We want to hear from the task force reports. We want to get the mechanics of the bills on the table. And my anticipation is that the debate on the bill and any decisions that will be made on Thursday. However, for those of you who will not be able to make it, who would like to give input, we want to hear what you have to say today, if you can't make it on Thursday. So, members, we will have almost a full hour today, session today, and plan for a full committee session on Thursday. We will go until 6. I will try at about 4:15 to recess for about 15 minutes for people to have a little bit of a breather. From here till perhaps the end of deadlines, as our committee meetings get long, I want to give us a little bit of a break in there so that people can kind of just stand up and stretch. But we have a very heavy load in front of us, not just today, but for the next 2 to 3 weeks. So I hope that the members will make the time to be here on time so we can start on time. But I want to thank you in advance. We will be delving into some pretty heavy work, and it will be some heavy thinking pretty late in the day. But I appreciate you being here. To start off with, I thought it would be helpful to give some context to this area that we are trying to get a handle on, particularly in the areas of background checks and expungements and collateral consequences. So before we hear from the two task force reports that are coming back to us, I've asked Senate counsel to present, give some background context for us. I'm going to have Mr. Backus talk to us a little bit about expungement and, in particular, sort of the different types of expungements are out there and what the current law is. And then I'm going to have Ms. Pontius talk to us a little bit about the legislative history on background checks, looking at the types of statutes that we've passed up until this point. This, I think, will give us a good historical context then to receive the report so that when we're hearing the reporters giving us the report, we can better understand it in the context of what current law is. So, Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There's a memo in your packets that I prepared giving an overview of the expungement issue, and I'll pretty much be working off of it. Basically, there are two types of expungements in Minnesota. There's statutory expungements, and there's inherent authority expungements. And within the world of statutory expungements, there are basically two types of them. The first has to do with identification data relating to arrests, fingerprints, photos, things like that. And that's codified at Section 299C.11. And the second type of statutory expungements is codified in Chapter 609A, and that deals with all criminal records. Under Section 299C.11, the subject of an arrest can ask for the return of the identification data from the BCA relating to the arrest. And this is a statutory right to get the records. The person doesn't have to make a petition or appear in court to get that. But, however, the person can only get this if all pending criminal proceedings related to the arrest were determined in the person's favor, and either the charges were dismissed before a probable cause determination was made, or the prosecutor declined to file charges and the person had not been indicted. So, as you can see, that requires a pretty early end to the criminal justice proceedings. In addition, to be eligible under this section, a person cannot have been convicted of a felony or a gross misdemeanor within the preceding 10 years. Now, the nice thing about this section from the person's point of view is if he qualifies, you can actually get the records back, and then you could either destroy them or do whatever you want to them. But the drawback is it is a somewhat limited in terms of eligibility, like who can qualify. Under Chapter 609A, that's the expungement law, that chapter provides for the sealing of criminal records. Now, not just arrest records, so it's broader in that context. However, the remedy only involves the sealing of these records. There's under no circumstances can the records be destroyed or returned to the subject under that law. Now, records that are sealed under the expungement law, under 609A, can be opened under certain limited circumstances. Upon an ex parte order for the purposes of a criminal justice investigation, prosecution, or sentencing, or without a court order for an evaluation of a prospective criminal justice system applicant for an employment situation or for DHS background checks. Now, under 609A, the actual order will affect both judicial branch and non-judicial branch records, so that would include law enforcement and the BCA and things like that. 609A expungements are authorized in only limited circumstances, though. For example, it applies to certain low-level controlled substance possession offenses where the offender has gotten a discharge and dismissal under Section 152.18. It also applies to juveniles who are convicted as adults, who are certified as adults and convicted of offenses. And then finally, it applies to persons for whom all proceedings were resolved in their favor. Now, the law provides that the granting of an expungement is an extraordinary remedy, and it's basically a balancing test. The court has to decide whether it would yield a benefit to the petitioner that equals the disadvantages to the public and public safety of sealing the record and burdening the court and public authorities with the responsibility of issuing, enforcing, and monitoring the expungement order. The standard of proof is a high one. It's clear and convincing evidence. And that standard is on, the burden is on the petitioner if the petitioner has been convicted of an offense, but it's on the government entity opposing the expungement if the proceedings had been resolved in the petitioner's favor. The chapter addresses things like the process for getting a expungement, what has to be in the petition, who must be notified, things like that. And it specifically prohibits expungements in cases involving sex crimes where predatory offender registration would be required. Now, of note, under 609A, when it was enacted by the legislature in 1996, the intent was to kind of bring some inherent authority expungements within the chapter, at least in terms of the chapter's notice provisions and the limitation on expungement. For example, that the records can only be sealed, that they couldn't be destroyed or returned to the subject, prohibition on sex offense crimes being expunged. So that brings us to inherent authority expungements. And here, these type of expungements have existed before the enactment of Chapter 609A, and it's clear that courts do maintain an authority currently. And these type of expungements are based on the constitutional separation of powers doctrine and the need for judicial self-preservation. A court may use its inherent authority to grant this relief when it's necessary to the performance of its unique judicial function. And within inherent authority expungements, there are basically two types. The first is where the petitioner's constitutional rights may be seriously infringed by the retention of the records, or when there's been abuse of discretion by a criminal justice agency in retaining the records. In these situations, the court's authority is at its greatest, and the court's order can affect not only court records, but also those executive branch records. The other type of expungement, inherent authority expungement, is basically a balancing test where the constitutional rights of the petitioner are not involved. And here it's almost the same balancing test as in the statute. The thing here, though, is if it's a non-constitutional case, then the court's inherent authority is going to be limited by case law, and then the order would only apply to judicial branch records, not to executive branch records. And that limitation acknowledges that a broader expungement order there would likely violate the separation of powers doctrine. There's a case that you might hear a bit about today. It's State v. Schultz, which was a 2004 Court of Appeals decision, which basically clarified the law on expungements. Before that point, there was some confusion as to, in non-constitutional cases, how broad the inherent authority would be. Schultz and some other cases have basically limited that to, as I said, to just affecting the judicial branch records, not the non-judicial branch records.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Members, any questions for Mr. Backus? I found this information to be very helpful.
Very clear.
Let the record reflect that we now have a quorum. Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have any written materials, although I can provide some more background information for anyone who's interested. I'm just going to touch briefly on the law governing access to criminal history records, particularly public access in general, and then a little bit on the background checks. I think you'll probably hear a lot more of that as part of the collateral consequences report. First of all, there's obviously a distinction between records of the judicial branch, court records regarding convictions, versus records that are maintained by law enforcement agencies and the BCA. It's interesting. I mean, historically, any court records of adult convictions have generally been accessible to the public. There wasn't an easy way to get at those records. Normally, you'd have to just kind of go case by case into a courthouse, maybe watch what was going on, see the newspaper, to find out about adult convictions. Now, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has, for a number of years, maintained criminal history records, but it wasn't until 1993 that those records were opened up to the general public. And at that time, what became language was, first of all, it's just conviction records that are open to the public. And it was anything that would identify someone who was convicted of a crime and the offense for which they were convicted. Now, these records only remain public for 15 years following discharge of the sentence. I think the rationale at the time, and this is still the law, was that, at some point in time, the public interest in having access dissipate. So I think at one point it might have been 10 years, then it became 15. And then this was in 1993. The next major change came in 2002, and basically just more of the criminal history information was made available to the public so that you could also get access to court disposition information and sentencing information and confinement information. And also at that time, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was required to provide at its central office a computer monitor where individuals could come and inspect the public data at no charge. The other big change with respect to accessibility dealt with internet access to these records. And this was originally added to the law in 2001 and then changed in 2003. But basically, the BCA was required to establish and maintain an internet website that contains the public criminal history data. And this, I'm not sure when the actual implementation took place. It was required by July 1, 2004. And there are special provisions dealing with access, notice to people in terms of what's included or not included on the site. There's currently a July 31, 2007 expiration date in that requirement, so I'm not sure where that's going to go from here. That might be an issue that will come up this session. I think in general, in terms of public access, there's kind of a difference of opinion as to there's public and then there's like data that are really public, and I think that is just because of the increased computerization and internet access that it does become a lot easier to get information. And then law has changed considerably since 1993 in that area. And at the same time that there have been changes in terms of public access to data, you've also seen kind of a tandem area of law developing with respect to the use of background checks. I think historically, I remember when these bills first started coming in, it frequently they were in response to a particular incident where someone was convicted of a crime and they were involved in something where the existence of a conviction would have been considered relevant to whatever activity they were engaged in, you know, child protection or child workers, people working with children. There was the Kerry Koskinen case that involved the caretaker, the manager for an apartment building, things like that. And then, of course, in the area of human services licensing, this has been a really big issue over the years. But basically, usually you have a situation where the existence of a conviction is considered relevant to performance of some particular function, like an employment or licensing. I think guardians now in court cases have to have some kind of a background check done. Gun permits, obviously, that's a big issue there. And I'm not going to go into a lot more detail on that. I do have more information if anybody's interested in getting it. And I also have a memo that's about 8 pages long, but it's kind of an interesting history of the law that deals with access to juvenile records because they've always been treated differently. Again, there has been kind of a movement over the year to have more records accessible to the public, although it certainly has not gone as far as the adult conviction records. But I think starting back in 1986, or I think was when some records first became accessible. So I have kind of a year-by-year summary of that if anyone is interested as well. So I'd be happy to provide any more information or answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Pontius. Any questions for Ms. Pontius? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pontius, there seems to be a thin line between expungements and how we seal records for pardon. And pardon, we don't necessarily seal the record from public or from law enforcement, but it appears to be sealed from the public once a pardon is made. And in talking with people that have come to me lobbying on expungements, I kind of sense that there is a confusion on the part of those seeking expungement, that they may be confusing expungements with pardons. And have you done any research on what the difference is between the two processes?
Ms. Pontius or Mr. Backus?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I mean, the only thing I can say is I think the expungement is really more of a record-keeping function, where the pardon process has more to do with actually being forgiven of the crime, so to speak. So it has implications beyond just the retention of records.
Well, the reason I bring this up is even though we as a state pardon board, which consists of the governor, the attorney general, and I don't know who the third one is.
Yeah, Chief Justice.
Yeah. Pretty weighty decision in order to pardon or forgive someone for a crime. We still don't keep records away from law enforcement to go back and research if they had to. And in some of these expungement plans, I suppose we'll find out later how far they go in sealing and keeping records out of public hands versus law enforcement. So I just want to keep that in mind as we do our expungement work in the next few days.
Ms. Pontius.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, too. I think there is some confusion, too. I mean, I myself have kind of gotten confused sometimes in the terminology because there's a difference between expungement in terms of access versus destroying records versus returning the records to the subject. So, and some of the bills are specific about applying to one but not the other. And then who has access, assuming that the records still exist and are retained by government entities. So.
One of the other things, Madam Chair,
to keep in mind is we
put certain citizens in liability if they don't do adequate research to find out if an employee, certain employees have to have background checks and how that liability would transfer if the record was expunged. And those are some of the questions that I'd like to have those who are bringing their bills forward to be prepared on so that we could have an adequate description of liability, how would liability follow in the event of an expungement based on their particular bills as well.
Senator Limmer, I think that the bills, as far as I'm concerned, are merely vehicles to provoke this committee to think about which direction we want to go in this arena. because I think there are a lot of public policy implications for what the bills themselves trigger, and I think we will have plenty of opportunities to delve into that discussion, not necessarily even specific to any of the bills, but I think that's a policy direction that we ought to discuss before we move into. So, Ms. Pontius, could you tell the committee, since Senator Limmer brought it up, what would be the effect on records, court records, and agency records, BCA records, if somebody did obtain a pardon?
Madam Chair, members of Mr. Backus and I were just looking at this actually in one of the reports. There's different kinds of pardons that you can get, and I don't know if you could maybe address that more directly.
Mr. Backus,
it depends on the kind of pardon.
Madam Chair and members, I think the broadest pardon I think is a pardon extraordinary, and in that case. I believe it doesn't seal or expunge the record, but a copy of the pardon would be filed with the district court, and it would be directed to set aside the conviction, and then the pardon would be included in the court file. And I was looking at there's I don't know if we have it in our packets, but there's a nice report the CrimNet group that put together the report that we're going to hear did a separate document with a lot of research and a lot of materials there, and it might be something that members want to page through. It does address pardons in that.
Very good. Any other questions to our two Senate counsels? I thought that would be very helpful to kind of lay out the context for us so that when we're receiving the report, we might be able to understand it a little bit more. All right. First on the agenda is the CrimNet presentation of the report and recommendations on background checks and expungements. Do you all want to come up to the table together or one at a time? Come up to you. Who wants to go first? Ms. Kirshner or Mr. Holmgren?
Madam Chair, I will be going first. My name is Debbie Kirshner.
Ms. Kirshner, before you begin, let me say that a lot of time and a lot of energy was invested by this group and the membership into coming back with a report to us. I know that a number of us weren't there at the creation of this group, but I'm very well aware of all the individuals, both in the public and from our different agencies who participated in putting thinking through and putting this report together. Our gratitude publicly goes out to all of you for your hard work and your dedication to make sure that we had a good product to report back to the committee. So thank you very much.
Ms. Kirshner. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Kirshner, and I'm here as chair of the CrimNet task force and also as a member of both the background check and expungement delivery team. And on behalf of both of those teams, I appreciate your kind words. A lot of members, many of whom are present today, did spend a lot of time and a lot of hours, and we allude to that a little bit in the presentation today. Because we do know that you have a full agenda and because we also know that the topic is very complex, we are going to try to give you a very high level presentation of a very complex topic, and obviously you all have copies of the report that was done by the delivery team, and we will make reference to some of the details in our presentation today so that you can reference that as time permits or at other times during the session. The issue of background checks and expungements is very complicated, as all of you are very aware. Two key incidents or events were brought to the CrimNet program office attention last year, which prompted the creation of these two delivery teams. The first is the area of the predatory offender registry and suspense records. Currently, the Department of Human Services is not allowed access to those records, even for statutorily mandated criminal background checks. In addition, as has already been discussed by one of your counsels today, the court decision known as State v. Schultz had an impact on how background checks and expungement records are dealt with in non-court agencies across the state. Given those two incidents or those two events, the CrimNet program office last year worked out an informal agreement with several members of the legislature to take a look at this very complex topic. As a part of their work, they required assistance from the Management Analyst and Development Division of the Department of Administration, and they did a lot of the field work and did a lot of the research that then the subcommittees actually used as the basis for their discussion. As has already been referenced, the groups met over 9 months and had over 56 hours of meetings. Due to the complexity of the issues, we actually divided into two subcommittees, one to deal directly with background checks that I'm going to be speaking to, and one dealing directly with expungements, which Steve Holmgren will be speaking to in just a moment. I would like to draw your attention to the fact that these are recommendations of the delivery team only. They have been forwarded for consideration to you by the policy group, but these recommendations have not yet been adopted by either the task force or the policy group. But these are the recommendations of the delivery teams. As a part of the task force process, we always try to ensure that we have membership from the task force itself as well as subject matter experts. So just briefly to let you know, this is the areas that were represented as a part of the background check delivery team. On the left-hand side, you will notice the membership that came from the task force, and on the right-hand side, you will notice the subject matter expert areas. These are people who actually deal with the implications of the statutes and the requirements related to background checks. For more details on who specifically attended and their attendance, if you will check in Appendix A of your final report on page 56 and 57, this just lets you know sort of a high level of all of the participants that dealt with this over the 9 month period. Our process was that we reviewed the research that the Management Analyst and Development Division had done. We reviewed the current statutorily mandated background check statutes. And to let you know how complex those are contained in Appendix B of your report. And they are on page 58 through 63. Those are all of the currently mandated background checks that Minnesota statute allows for. We tried to do an informal process. We wound up doing a modified Roberts Rules of Order process to try to get to some recommendations. And then this final report was forwarded to the task force for review and discussion. The five areas that we discussed as the background check delivery team are these. What criminal justice data should be included? What circumstances should we do fingerprint-based checks? How do we balance informed consent and privacy protections? When should a background check be mandatory? And how should we fund those background checks? And no, I'm not going to commit those to memory, but we are going to discuss those in a little bit more detail. But before we do that, this was the framework for our discussion. We recognize that background checks are put in place so that we can protect vulnerable populations and so that we can protect the general public. And given that, these were the foundations for the recommendations that the delivery team made. And that was, we need to reduce the complexity, we need to make them consistent. However, we need to protect the vulnerable populations while still balancing the presumption of innocence and providing safeguards for the subjects of background checks. And also, how do we ensure identity without somehow relying in some situations on fingerprint-based background checks? So that was the foundation for all of our discussions as a part of that delivery team. And again, what we're going to be looking at now are the recommendations of the delivery team itself in the area of background checks. That first priority area, what criminal justice data should be included in background checks? If you've seen the grid of the 38 existing statutorily authorized background checks, they are not always consistent. Not all of them are mandated. Not all of them even define what a background check is. So what the delivery team spent quite a bit of their time doing was developing a consistent grid. And that grid is on page 10 and 11 of your report that basically says every background check that we authorize through statute should fit into these four areas. And those four areas are key because they're determined based on the vulnerability of the populations that we're trying to protect based on those background checks.
Ms. Kirshner, can you hang on? As we're moving through this, if you would like to ask questions about a particular area, please, you know, feel free to do that so that we're getting some progress, because if we get too deep into the end and you want to draw back, we might not be able to round robin back. So is that all right with you?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
Basically, we created the grid of four components based on the risk to the public or to vulnerable populations. Now, given the extensive nature of the 38 background checks, we were only able to categorize the first 18, and you will see those noted on the chart. Our recommendation is that that grid should be used for all current background checks, but as well as all future statutorily created background checks, and that the delivery team would like to complete its work and complete all 38 of the existing, because they could all then be plotted into that existing grid. Our second major priority area was under what circumstances should state and national fingerprint checks be performed. The recommendation in this area, because currently fingerprint-based background checks are only done in areas where, as you'll notice in one of the categories on the current grid, is some of them require an FBI check, and the FBI check requires fingerprints. Those are currently the only background checks done that require a fingerprint, and our recommendation is that all fingerprint that we require fingerprint-based checks of the state criminal history repository, even if a FBI check is not required. Now, this would be enable us to ensure that we had the correct identity. However, as you all will be discussing later, there are cost issues that would need to be considered if this were to be implemented.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam, you continue to make reference to a grid.
Yes.
Is there a grid represented in any of the documents that we could look at?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding that you all have a copy of the delivery team report, and that was referenced on page 10 and 11.
It's there.
Senator Limmer. Yeah. Ms. Kirshner, and then the 38 occupations, is that is that on, let's see, is that on Appendix B?
Madam Chair, that's
page 58?
Correct. It starts on page 58, Madam Chair, yes.
Ms. Kirshner, those are the 38 to date statutorily created background checks.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
That
this grid was actually created, I believe, by House Research. But it does categorize all of the current statutorily authorized background checks.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the third area that the delivery team discussed was what informed consent and individual privacy protection should be in place. The committee was very concerned about discussing the need to balance the rights of the individual who was having the background check performed on them, and made the following set of procedures as their recommendation. And they center around some very basic concerns, and that is that you let the person know that you're conducting a background check on them, that you give them notice of disqualifying offenses in the job that they happen to be applying for, that you provide them a copy of the background check when it's complete, that you give them notice of their data subject rights, and then you let them know when the background check was completed. And a particular recommendation was that we do a use limitation. So if an agency has done a background check on an individual for one purpose, that's the only purpose that check can be used for. They couldn't use it later for a different job, a different situation, without going through this particular set of individual protections again. The fourth area that the delivery team discussed was, when should a background check be mandatory? Again, if you would reference the current set of authorized background checks, which start on page 58, the committee felt that two of those that are noted in the non-mandatory category but deal with individuals who work with vulnerable populations, particularly individuals 18 or under and in the school system, should be actually changed to be mandatory background checks. And in particular, those are K-12 volunteers or student employees working in school districts, or employees or volunteers for nonprofits or private public agencies who work with children and aren't otherwise covered by statute. Now, the concern of the group here was that would be contingent upon our funding recommendation, which I will get to in a moment. The fifth and final area that the delivery team discussed was the funding area, and that is how should background checks be funded and who should pay for them. The delivery team felt that volunteers and in the areas of nonprofits or political subdivisions where that background check is mandatory, they felt that those agencies should have those background checks covered by state agencies rather than the volunteer themselves or the volunteer agency being required to pay for those. In addition, the delivery team felt that the direct cost of providing these background checks for these volunteers where not otherwise reimbursed for federal and state records should be covered as well, again, through state funding. There were some additional issues that even after 9 months, the delivery team was not able to cover. As I mentioned earlier, we were only able to cover the first 18 in categorizing the background checks into the grid that we're recommending. However, topics for future study that we think would be important to continue are the impact of data harvesters in the area of background checks, how we simplify the administration of this area across the multiple agencies who are having to perform background checks, how this interplays with the area of rehabilitation, as well as ensuring for continued legal protection in this area. So these were the areas that the group did not complete discussion but felt still needed to be covered in future work of a group such as this. That completes my overview of background checks. Depending on whether there are additional questions, I will then turn this over to Steve Holmgren.
Any questions for Ms. Kirshner? Ms. Kirshner, can I take you back to the grid of the 38 statutorily mandated background checks? Can you talk us through the and looking at the 38 and then go to the on the page 10. Can you talk us through the rationale for how you went about categorizing them into these different into the new grid on page 10 and 11?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be able to give you an overview. For more details, we do have Judy Grew here from the Management Analysts and Development Division who facilitated our group in working through these areas. But basically, we started out realizing that we needed to start out with the areas of least risk who needed the least information, which would be level D, which basically is getting public information. And then we worked our way up through level C, B, and A. And as you will notice, as you go further up the alphabet, you're getting additional information than what you had in the lower level. So our rationale was, as the risk to the vulnerable population increased, or as that vulnerable population is less able to speak for themselves, that we felt that it was our mandate to try to get them access to additional information to safely provide for them and the public. And I can turn this over to Judy, who may be able to provide you some additional detail.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Grew from Management Analysis and Development of the Department of Administration. One thing I would add to the facilitation method that we used to go from the 38 checks and to try to consolidate that into categories. On page 14, you'll find some of the questions we asked ourselves while categorizing different background checks. When we take a risk-based approach, what are some of the questions we're asking in assigning different background checks to different levels of risk? Those are, who is being protected from risk and how vulnerable are they to harm? How isolated is the relationship or contact with that population? What is the authority or power relationship with the population served? To what extent is this a position of public trust, which is always a difficult thing to define, but sometimes you just know it when you see it. And to what extent will there be access or control of electronic systems or architecture? So in addition to vulnerable populations, we're also looking at vulnerable systems, and as well to what extent will there be access to or control of sensitive data. So there's vulnerable populations, vulnerable systems, and vulnerable data as well. Those are kind of the guiding principles for the categorization.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful. Any additional questions for Ms. Grew? Very good. Mr. Holmgren, you're going to go over the expungement piece of the report.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for having me today. My name's Steve Holmgren, and I'm the first vice chair of the CRIMNET Task Force. As Ms. Kirshner mentioned, our intent today is really to give you a sort of a bird's eye overview of the work of our delivery team. But to that end, we put together this PowerPoint, which really just tries to summarize the major points of our report or our recommendation. As in the background check portion of our delivery team, the expungement delivery team sought a diverse membership. We looked at, and our goal really was to try to get a wide variety of points of view. And to that end, we invited basically any of the task force members who were interested in coming, and also invited additional interested people that we thought might be relevant to or might have some opinions on this issue. We also had the benefit of having some technical advisors from Minnesota House Research, Management Analysis Division folks. And over a series of 9 months, we held 15 meetings, and I can tell you they were very spirited meetings. This is a very, we had a very interesting and spirited crew here. We began our process by, first of all, looking at the Management Analysis Division or Development report. If you're not aware, if you haven't seen that, basically what MAD did was to go out and survey stakeholders and ultimately condensed all these divergence points of view into a report for us. And we started off with that to sort of get some background into the situation. Then what we did was try to determine some sort of decision-making structure. Initially, we had hoped, at least leadership had hoped, to try to make some decisions by consensus, but I'm afraid that we were a bit naive on that. So ultimately what we did is, just like the background check team did, was to use a modified Roberts Rule approach. If we couldn't reach consensus, someone was allowed to make a motion and we voted on issued. What we did, though, is we wanted to respect the minority views. So what we proposed, and we did this both with background checks and the expungement portions of this, is to allow folks to write minority reports, and those should be included also in your packet. Ultimately, our goal in this expungement team was to first of all, I think we realize that criminal conviction shouldn't be the end of people's useful life. The majority of people who are convicted of crimes will be released from prison, will get back out into society, and really have needs for housing, employment, and the like. And that it was really kind of counterproductive to the rehabilitative end of the criminal justice system if folks weren't giving meaningful opportunities for employment and for housing and that type of thing. Secondly, we wanted to make some recommendations that would be real in the sense that would actually have some impact on minimizing these collateral consequences of criminal convictions. We did recognize, however, that we needed to balance public safety, versus the public's right to know versus the individual's need to get back and be a productive member of society. We also recognize that, and the delivery team didn't want to thwart the background check laws. So what we'll be recommending here, as you'll see in a few minutes, is that even expunged records would remain available in most cases for statutorily mandated background checks. We also wanted to make sure that we considered fairness and consistency. So what we came up with basically are a series of recommendations. You'll see in a minute that we're recommending that in some situations expungements be automatic. That meaning automatic means that a person need not petition, but that some sort of administrative mechanism kicks into effect. I'll get to those in a second. One of the other overriding principles is that criminal justice agencies, at least most of them, should have access to expunged records. The intent of this delivery team was to try to minimize sort of the collateral consequences that society imposes on persons and not to hamstring or handicap the criminal justice system dealing with folks should they return to the criminal justice system. One of the other overriding principles was that folks should be required to demonstrate rehabilitation if they have been convicted. If they're seeking an expungement of a conviction, they should demonstrate rehabilitation before or prior to seeking an expungement. We also recognize, though, that the court has inherent authority to grant expungements, although limited that may be to just their own records, but that we thought that ultimately a comprehensive solution would require that a statute be enacted that would expand the situations in which expungements may be thought or sought so that folks wouldn't have to always go to the court under the inherent authority provision. So as I mentioned, we recommended, first of all, that there be some automatic expungements. In the first category, are those involving arrests and or dismissals that did not result in conviction. We're recommending that in the case of non-person crimes, when an arrest does not result in a charge, that an expungement automatically occur within 1 year of arrest. And secondly, that when charges are dismissed, an expungement would be triggered automatically within 1 year of the dismissal. The idea here was that folks should not have to suffer civil disability if there was no conviction. But it's important also to keep in mind that this information is still available to law enforcement and criminal justice agencies so that they can have access to this. The idea was to not impose a disability in the public sort of sector by reason of an arrest or a charge that didn't result in a conviction.
Mr. Holmgren, what's the rationale behind the 1 year?
Madam Chair, that was hotly debated, and I was trying to remember that the other day, but what I think the rationale was that it was a recognition that there needed to be some time out there in which an arrest would be public so that I know there was a lot of concern with law enforcement about the ability to not impede their investigations. The reason why I hesitate with that answer is that the actual recommendation is that they still have access to this. But I think there's also a recommendation that, or there's also a recognition that it takes time for the court to administratively process these things, and that it is, I think, going to impose some amount of burden on the court. So the discussion was very wide-ranging, but ultimately we thought, okay, it's a good idea to automatically expunge these, but that a one-year period would help protect some of these other interests and give them time to operate rather than forcing this upon the courts. And if I haven't said so, actually, in this case, when a charge has been filed, it would be sort of an automatic administrative expungement that a court administrator would perform. Otherwise, if it was just an arrest with no charges, that it would be an administrative sort of expungement by the police department. The second area of automatic expungements is the area of, back up a second here, is the area of continuances for dismissal, stays of adjudication, and completing of a diversion program. The intent in these situations was that what we really wanted to do is facilitate what the court is already working towards. Generally, when a person is given a continuance for dismissal, a stay of adjudication, or is allowed to enter into a diversion program, the intent is for folks to be able to work a conviction or the potential for a conviction off of their record. Conditions are imposed, and if they meet those, then the intent here is that there not be a conviction. So the team thought it would be appropriate in these cases just to do this administratively and to try to help facilitate the intent of the court and the prosecution and defense counsel when they reach these types of agreements. I should note that the prosecutors, these are in situations where the prosecutor, in fact, has agreed to the stay of adjudication or the continuance for dismissal. If the judge did this over prosecution objection, then the recommendation of the team is to require folks to do the actual petitioning to be able to take these off their records. The next area was in regard to expungement of convictions. As you heard earlier, the present statute does not authorize a wide variety of expungements for convictions. It seems to be limited primarily to low-level drug offenses. The delivery team felt that it would be appropriate to expand expungement to convictions, but that there would be some sort of a waiting period would be necessary to be able to for people to be eligible to petition. So you'll see a chart here of various waiting periods that were thought to be appropriate.
So, Mr. Holmgren, walk us through this chart.
If you, for example, were convicted of a felony crime and it was a person crime, the recommendation of this team was to, you'd have to wait 15 years from the day of discharge from sentence, okay? The day you successfully completed your probation or were discharged from prison, and you completed all of the sentencing conditions from that date forward, what I show in a later slide is that you also have to remain free from future convictions, but you become eligible after these waiting periods. So a person crime, this delivery team thought it would be a longer period would be appropriate. And a property or a drug crime, for example, other crimes, it was felt that a lesser period would be appropriate. So the idea would be to allow people to be able to demonstrate rehabilitation.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Question I had is, had you given any comparison to the pardon process? And the reason I keep bringing it up, it seems like a pardon might be, the process for pardon is kind of an upper bar as far as giving us some parameters on this. In order to be eligible for a person crime pardon, one has to wait a minimum of 10 years after a sentence has been commuted. Why, for the purposes of expungement, did you recognize 15 years for a person crime felony?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Holmgren.
Senator, these numbers were really negotiated out amongst the group. And I think, first of all, the pardon process, we looked at some statistics about that, and it was a very small number of pardons that were actually granted each year. Originally, we had some discussions about, well, should we recommend loosening up, for lack of a better phrase, the pardon process. Ultimately, we decided that the pardon process at this point was too cumbersome, and we didn't know whether or not it was the type of process that we actually had detailed knowledge of. But we thought was much more real in the sense of a solution here would be to allow expungements and convictions where they don't exist now, but to wait for the waiting period so that there would be a chance to rehabilitate folks, and they would be able to demonstrate that. So I'm not sure if I've exactly answered your question, but we did look at the pardon process, and we concluded that just by its very nature, it was difficult to do, and very few pardons actually could be heard in a given year. I recall something about they only meet periodically while courts are in session regularly. So ultimately, we decided in favor of the expungement process.
Ms. Holmgren, also, can you touch on this? What is the effect on the record between a pardon and an expungement? What happens to both the you know, court record and the agency records? Ms. Grew, you can come up to the table and participate if you would like.
As you can see, I had to refer to Ms. Grew on that. Our joint recollection is that a person is pardoned, but there's a notation on the record that a pardon was granted. So it's still accessible as far as the public's concerned. Well, an expungement, it would be sealed from public view.
Please, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Holmgren, can you explain the rationale for excluding traffic offenses from convictions that would be expunged under the normal graph that you have? And was there a particular stakeholder group that was interested in this issue?
Mr. Holmgren?
Madam Chair, Senator, our scope of our study was to, first of all, try to limit ourselves to criminal convictions. And generally, our understanding of the traffic law was that most traffic type offenses drop off of a record after a period of time, or that there are other means of doing that. But that, in general, except in perhaps DWI type situations, serious traffic offenses, it was a situation where the discussion was focused primarily on public safety, whether or not this was a appropriate area of crime to try to include, and we just ultimately decided that we would focus on the much more serious type offenses that may very well hamper folks in their employment, their housing, that type of thing.
Senator Leo Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Holmgren, I'm less concerned with the other elements of your grid, but it strikes me as that petty misdemeanor is clearly defined as not a crime, and I feel very uncomfortable with the addition of those. Can you tell me, I know there's some thing in the literature here that you explain that away, but it seems fairly shallow and not appropriate.
Madam Chair, Holmgren. Senator, in all honesty, Senator, I don't recall exactly what the discussion was. I know my friends who are prosecutors felt that proposed this grid and ultimately felt that it was an appropriate provision. I think that there are certain convictions that are deemed to be petty misdemeanors just by reason of a fine imposed, for example, theft, certain disorderly conducts. The court can make a conviction a petty misdemeanor by reason of their action, yet it still is a substantial amount, a substantial conviction on someone's record. And there was a thought that even if in the situations where the court actually does this, that there still ought to be some sort of a waiting period for a person prior to petitioning.
Please continue, Mr. Holmgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the area of convictions, if an expungement is granted, it's important to remember that our recommendation is that these expungements be effective on both judicial and executive branch records. And actually, that applies to automatic expungements, too. We recognize that the State versus Schultz decision is really a handicap in a person, in the sense of a person trying to get an expungement and clearing their record. So what we're looking to do in all these situations is to be able to try to address State versus Schultz by encouraging some sort of legislation that would apply to both executive and judicial branch records. We're not looking to try to change existing law, even though we don't, or I should say existing statute. We're not looking to take away existing statute. We're looking to add to existing statute to make more options and more alternatives for expungement available. As I mentioned earlier, one of the requirements is that you rehabilitate yourself. And the majority of the members of this committee felt that prior to being eligible for expungements, it was important that all sentencing convictions be completed. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the time periods in the grid start over if a person receives a new conviction of a felony, gross misdemeanor, or targeted misdemeanor. Finally, on this slide anyway, I mentioned earlier that this is limited to, or our recommendations do not apply to traffic offenses or crimes in which you have to register under the predatory offender statute. There was a concern about public safety and predatory offender registration law, and that we felt that it was important for persons to have to continue to register, and that they shouldn't be able to use an expungement to avoid that. As I mentioned, you have to complete.
Senator Higgins has a question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Holmgren, what's a targeted misdemeanor?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Holmgren.
Senator, a targeted misdemeanor is a misdemeanor that can be used to enhance. Basically, what it is an assault, a DWI, serious level misdemeanors that if you get a second or subsequent violation of can be used. They can use that first conviction against you. So if you get a second assault, for example, becomes a gross misdemeanor. A first one's a misdemeanor. If you get a third one, that third assault could become a felony, that type of thing. So targeted misdemeanors are those special category of misdemeanors that have lasting consequences if you continue on with criminal behavior. One of the recommendations is that we wanted to make sure that certain juvenile and extended juvenile jurisdiction offenses be eligible for expungement. Right now, most juvenile convictions are sealed from the public. However, certain convictions, juvenile convictions and extended juvenile jurisdiction convictions are, in fact, public. And we wanted to make this remedy available should someone be convicted of one of these types of offenses, too, as a juvenile. As I mentioned earlier, if an expungement is granted, it's our intent that government agencies should still be able to use these convictions in statutorily mandated background checks. The feeling of the team was that expungement should not thwart the ability to do a background check. However, the one caveat the group thought was important was that there should be some sort of process for the agent built within the agency to do some sort of administrative or judicial review. Our concern was that people, oftentimes we find situations where people, there's some confusion about a conviction, or they may not actually have been convicted, or there may be some extenuating circumstances around a conviction, and we thought that they should have the ability try to explain what the situation was. So we hope that would somehow balance the due process interest of the person versus the public safety interest of that are trying to be protected by background checks.
Mr. Holmgren, perhaps once the collateral consequences report people come up, we'll address this issue again. But In terms of the record still being available to government agencies to conduct statutory background checks, then what good is an expungement to somebody who's gone through the process if they're still readily available for the statutory background checks and to courts and to law enforcement, prosecutors, probation officers? I mean, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose of expunging your record?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Holmgren.
Well, I guess it does and it doesn't. What our delivery team was primarily focusing on were the collateral consequences of convictions. We didn't want to handicap law enforcement. We didn't want to handicap the courts. What we wanted to do was focus in on people being able to get jobs and find housing and just basic sort of human needs to allow folks to rehabilitate themselves from their legal indiscretions. It is true, certainly, that it's available for background checks. But the thought is that the statutory mandated background checks are in a sort of are in areas that are so important. The public safety is so important that it would be appropriate to know about a person's background in those situations. So it was, again, trying to balance the public safety versus the individual liberty interest at stake.
Please continue. Oh, sorry. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, in areas where we require by statute that in a particular employer conduct a background check, if the record has been expunged but it's not, the employer is not one of these not law enforcement or someone connected with the courts, would the record then not be accessible to that employer?
Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, what we were focusing in on in this delivery team was to try to look at situations where the background checks are available or are conducted by a government agency. It's my understanding that the Department of Human Services has a branch. In fact, they were represented on the background check committee that actually does background checks in many of the statutorily mandated background check situations. So what we'd limited this to was where the government agency does the background check and that they have some sort of process in place to review either administratively or judicially review it. So this only applies when the government agency does the background check.
Senator Higgins.
No.
Madam Chair, I think when landlords or neighborhood folks are looking for information, doing a background check, there are oftentimes like a community-oriented policing officer who will help with those background checks on kind of an informal basis in some of the communities.
Mr. Holmgren?
If that kind of thing happened, would these expunged records then not be out there in the public again, if you were a landlord and you know you had an officer who would do a background check for you, because you're keeping them open to law enforcement, wouldn't the possibility exist that an expunged record then would become public in an instance like a landlord?
Mr. Holmgren?
Madam Chair, Senator. We weren't aware of situations where law enforcement would be able to provide this type of information absent some sort of specific statutory authorization. It was our belief, maybe naive, that police officers could not offer that type of information to citizens absent some sort of authorization in law. So I would assume if the legislature authorized that type of practice, then that information could become available. And our recommendation would be, provided that the police department in that case had some sort of review process to allow the subject of the record to come in and contest that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Holmgren, maybe I'm just confused, but I still didn't quite understand the answer to the question I asked before. And maybe I can just differentiate. You have some lists of people who can do background checks, and it does not say anything about government agencies generally. And I'm thinking specifically in the area of employment. There are certain employment situations, as you know, where certain employers are required by statute to conduct a mandatory background check. There are other situations where employers choose to conduct a background check with the consent and permission of the employee. And I'm trying to find out, in the employment context, these expunged records, will they be able to be found or not found? And is there a difference between the statutory situation and the voluntary situation?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Holmgren.
Senator, in reality, there are really two different types of background checks, one conducted by a government agency, and then there's these private background checks that are all over the Internet. You pay $20, you can get a background check. The committee feels it's important for the legislature to address how expungements relate to those private background checks. We don't have a solution for you. I'll get to that in a few minutes, but it's a very complex area and something we just ran out of time. We didn't get to. But in the area of background checks conducted by a government agency, if the statute requires a government agency to conduct the check, it's our delivery team's recommendation that these expunged records be available to that government agency only if they have some sort of review process available. So if assuming that something was done to retract, maybe, I'm not sure the exact word, a government, if an expungement is granted and it is out there in a public, private database somewhere, if something were to be done where that would have to be redacted or taken out of the private database, then an expungement would have an effect on that private database, and it would not be available.
Senator Olson, I think that another slice at your question is that it would depend on who the employer is, and it would depend on what the job is. If the employer, and then it would depend on the job, whether it was a job that fell into a category where we've authorized a statutory background check, like a nursing home worker. They would obviously be, you know, covered under this report. But let's say that your employer and the job doesn't fall under a statutorily authorized background check. Then I think that the employer might not be able to get the information if it's been expunged. But what Mr. Holmgren is referring to is that then there are a number of data, private data harvesters out there who have private data databases that the employer could go to get some of this information, because those individuals purchase a lot of this public data from the public entities that are out there. Does that help?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I guess I was just confused because we're talking about expunged records being accessible to the courts and so forth, and it doesn't say anything about government agencies there. But perhaps they'll be doing – that was the only reason for my confusion.
Mr. Holmgren, can you repeat what the impact would be? That your recommendation is that it would also cover government agencies, the expungements, but that it would still be accessible to government agencies, correct?
Madam Chair, the information would be accessible to criminal justice agencies, I think, would be more specifically. We're not trying to impede law enforcement, the courts. It wouldn't necessarily be accessible to the Department of Administration, for example, unless they were mandated to do a statutorily mandated background check. So we're not intending that this be these expunged records be accessible to all government agencies, just criminal justice-related agencies, and those who conduct background checks pursuant to a statutory mandate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That clarifies my question.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to try to marry the collateral consequences into this area that we're currently dealing with? It seems to me that some of those things need clarifying, and this might not be the place to do it.
Senator Foley, the collateral consequences report will be next once this group is finished. Will that, perhaps in that report, we could engage in the discussion that's being brought up by this area? Can you wait until we get to the collateral consequences?
I think that's appropriate.
That would be great. Thanks. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'd like to just ask a follow-up to Senator Olson's question. So if a private employer chooses to do a background check, he usually gets the employee to sign an authorization. Will an expunged record be available with the employer's employees or prospective employees' authorization?
Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, Senator, we didn't address that issue specifically. We felt, in general, that people could consent to providing their information. They wouldn't have to consent, but if they did, they would. It would not be available unless they turned it over in some manner.
Well,
it would be sealed from...
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it won't do much good because they're going to get the authorization, aren't they? And so, I mean, the whole... My concept, and maybe I was wrong, but is that when it's expunged, I should be able to sign an authorization saying give them everything that isn't expunged, but the expunged stuff shouldn't be released even with an authorization. But you didn't address that?
Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, Senator, I can tell you, my other life, I'm a public defender. I certainly argued that vehemently on behalf, but ultimately the committee's decision, the delivery team's decision, was such that we didn't quite get to that point. I mean, ultimately, we had to focus in on what we could agree on. And these recommendations are, for the most part, subject to these minority reports, what we could pretty much agree on. There is very... I agree with you. I'm extremely concerned personally about that problem, but it's not something that we decided.
Okay. Thanks.
Please continue, Mr. Holmgren.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to skip ahead here. Before I come back to this slide, I'd like to point out, first of all, what expunged the delivery team is recommending expunged records be available for. As you can see, the public safety orientation of this committee was such that it was these expunged records are going to be available for gun law violations, sex offender registration proceedings or sex offender registration purposes, future expungement proceedings, sentencings, subsequent prosecution, other crimes evidence that's we refer to in Minnesota, trailers refer to as Spriegel evidence, impeachment, probation, and as I mentioned earlier, statutorily mandated background checks. And the reason that is, and I keep coming back to this, is that what this committee was primarily focusing on was trying to find a solution to the collateral consequence problem of convictions. The fact, as I always go back to housing and employment, but that the committee felt strongly it should not hamper law enforcement, corrections, that type of situation. So I'm going to back up now to my previous slide. The committee recommended that the effect of a expungement order actually put the person back in a position to where they were prior to the conviction. But what the committee recommended deleting was a provision that said that a person could not be convicted of perjury should they testify that they were never convicted of a crime that was expunged. Now, go back to this slide. One of the common examples is in certain situations in the courtroom, an attorney can cross-examine a person about a prior conviction. And a person under current expungement law, as I understand it, could say, no, I was not convicted of that, because generally expunged convictions under current law, as I understand it, these convictions are not, you have the right to say, I was never convicted. This delivery team felt that they didn't want to impair the use of expunged convictions in a court situation, for example. So they took out the provision about perjury so that a person, if they did not acknowledge a conviction in a court proceeding, could in fact be prosecuted. Hope that's not too confusing. One of the other recommendations was that it was encouraged, it was not required, that petitioners attach a copy of complaint police reports with a petition for expungement. The concern was that these expungement petitions can be brought decades perhaps after a conviction, and that there could be some difficulty in finding out circumstances of the conviction. So it was recommended by the committee to attach police reports. Some of the other issues we discussed but did not address in great detail were certificates of rehabilitation. The committee believed that certificates of rehabilitation do have a use, but that they're not a standalone solution. I think quite a few folks on the committee felt that if there was a certificate of rehabilitation statute, basically it would act like a pardon where people would know of a conviction, but that someone would be deemed to have no longer be a danger or be rehabilitated. We felt that that could be worth pursuing, but that it wasn't a standalone remedy. Finally, data harvesters was a huge issue that we started to address, but ultimately ran out of time. Data harvesters, as I think most of you may know, are these commercial businesses who sell background checks. And one of the concerns that the committee thought has to be studied further was how you could expunge something from a government record, but it would still be available privately, since a government, at least under current law, doesn't have any authority to reach into the private databases and require an expungement record be removed from that. We did not get to that. Because of it would certainly take a huge amount of effort and discussion to do that, and we already spent 9 months at this, and we didn't quite get to that point. Finally, I would just like to point out that there are minority reports available.
Senator Neville.
Got a question on the private data collectors. Do they collect? Do they have access to the FBI data too? So if you hire a private background check. I thought you said they need fingerprints and what have you. Or are we talking only the state data?
Mr. Holmgren?
Madam Chair, Senator. I know the FBI requires fingerprints to be able to get access to that data, but it doesn't mean it's not accessible from other sources. I know the data harvesters get data from our court system now, not necessarily fingerprint-based convictions, but... I don't know that they get it directly from the FBI.
So they could get it straight from a court records or...
jail records.
Okay. All right. So your understanding, though, is that the private background check outfits give complete background checks, including the data that would be on the FBI list?
Senator, we have no idea whether they're complete or not.
Okay.
They're in the business of selling data, and... where they get the data, I don't know that it's regulated, at least to our committee's knowledge. We didn't see any regulation of that whole industry at this point.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Holmgren, I think the other end of that answer is that they're also in the business of buying data. And one of the things that this committee should think about is who are they buying the public data from? Just planting a seed and giving you some food for thought.
Madam Chair, just to wrap up, I'd like to point out, and it's very important to the task force, for this committee to realize that the task force decided to pass on this recommendation without recommendation. They passed on this report, I should say, without recommendation. And the policy group also will be weighing in on these issues further in coming months. I think there's some hearings, some meetings scheduled by the policy group in May, as I understand it, to further look at some of these issues.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Holmgren or Ms. Kirshner? Will you two be able to hang around for a little bit? We're going to take a short break for the chair's benefit as well as for some of the members' benefit, and then we'll come back. We want to hear from the collateral consequences task force. But if there are any kind of overlapping questions, I would like it if you could be around to answer them.
Certainly.
All right. All right. The committee is in recess until 10:02. The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come back to order. Before we get to the collateral consequences presentation, Commissioner Ellison, sorry, I would like to have Mr. Holmgren, if you could come back up. During the recess, Mr. Holmgren and I were chatting, and I believe Mr. Holmgren has some clarification or clarifying comments about the question that was asked by Senator Neville earlier with respect to permission.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Holmgren.
Senator Neville, I think I misspoke or perhaps misled some way in response to your question about whether data, whether a subject of an expunged record could consent to the government's release of an expunged record. I spoke with my friend here at the BCA who advises me that under current practice, the BCA will not allow an expunged record to be released, even if the subject authorizes that. And it's my understanding that the intent of the delivery team was not to change that practice to permit someone to be able to release that or to permit government to release that. They certainly could release that on their own if they chose to, but it wouldn't come from a government source.
Thank you for that. Yeah. I appreciate the clarification. All right. Now we're on to the Department of Public Safety's presentation of the report on collateral consequences. We have with us Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison and Mr. Robert Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and in the capacity here today to talk about the Collateral Consequences Committee. With me is Robert Johnson, Anoka County Attorney. Mr. Johnson was on the Collateral Consequences Committee, and after I give just a very brief overview of the work of the committee, then Mr. Johnson will add some comments. The Collateral Consequences Committee was created through House File 2656, which was passed during the 2006 regular legislative session. The committee was convened by the Department of Public Safety as required by statute, and I served as the committee chair. The membership on the committee, some of the members are here in the audience today, included Mr. Johnson, whom I've mentioned, Leonardo Castro, Hennepin County Chief Public Defender, Brock Hunter, attorney at law. He was representing the private defense bar. Olita Uloa from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Crime Victim Services. The Honorable Charles Porter, District Court Judge from Hennepin County. He was appointed to the committee by the courts. Patricia Alfredson, a Rochester Assistant City Attorney, representing city attorneys. Tracy Green, representing the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, representing probation officers. And then staff support was provided by Bill Gelker from the Department of Corrections, Jacqueline Krause from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and Danette Biskovich from the Department of Public Safety. Basically, the statute indicated that the committee was established to study collateral consequences of adult convictions and juvenile adjudications. It goes on to state that the committee shall identify the uses of collateral consequences of convictions and adjudications and recommend any proposed changes to the legislature on collateral consequences. Basically, there are six major areas in which collateral consequences affect a person's life. and they involve include civic participation, employment, family, financial, housing, and immigration. In Minnesota, collateral consequences occur in many of these six arenas. Offenders with a felony conviction are barred from voting while incarcerated. Individuals can be barred from certain professions based on conviction, face registration if convicted of certain offenses, and may be barred from adopting a child or may have their parental rights terminated. A review by the staff of 59 selected statutory collateral consequences found that all but two of those consequences could be imposed based on the offense charged, not on the sentencing level. This means that the nature of the offense can trigger consequences regardless of the sentence that is ultimately imposed. It was very hard for us to determine the exact number of Minnesotans who are impacted by collateral consequences, but we were able to gather some data that might be helpful in shedding some light on this. In 2005, approximately 7,126 adult men and women with a felony conviction were transitioned from prison back into the community in Minnesota. In 2004, a total of 14,751 offenders were given a felony-level sentence for a sex, drug, or theft offense. Also in 2005, there were 15,915 felony-level theft, sex, and drug cases filed with the Minnesota court system. One of the main reasons for creating the Collateral Consequences Committee, as I understood it, was to achieve transparency. After the committee was passed, the language was passed in statute and this task was given to us at the Department of Public Safety, I tried to find people who were responsible for actually getting the bill passed and had a hard time finding people that took credit for it. Some people said, well, it was the county attorneys, and I talked to county attorneys. They said, well, no, not really. I mean, we have a particular county attorney that's interested in it. He's sitting at the table with me, but it was the public defenders. And so I talked to John Stewart, state public defender. He said, well, no, not really. I think it was Senator Neville's bill. And so I ultimately ended up chatting with Senator Neville and also Representative Doug Meslow, who were instrumental in getting the language passed. And they both indicated to me that one of the main concerns that they had in creating this committee was to make collateral consequences more visible and make the whole issue more transparent to the legislature and to the public. And that certainly, if that was one of the main goals, and I believe that really was one of the main goals, that has been accomplished. The reviser of statutes was directed to create a new chapter of law that cross-references the 200 collateral sanctions that currently exist in Minnesota law. She provided testimony to our committee, and that chapter 609B.050 is now available online. In an effort to bring further consistency in state laws regarding collateral consequences, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws is drafting uniform acts and model legislation to encourage consistency in state laws. Minnesota's Reviser of Statutes, Michelle Timmons, serves on that commission, and that is a group, and the results of the work of that group would be, I think, very helpful for this committee and the legislature to consider as you look at changes to collateral consequences in Minnesota. Our recommendations are basically that we need a more narrow scope before we can make any specific recommendations. Our committee came together and certainly reached the conclusion that this is a huge and complex issue, really is demanding of significant attention and thoughtful discussion. But we didn't have the time or the resources. We were given this task, of course, without staff, without funding, and really without real clear direction other than just to come back with some recommendations as to what really the legislature wanted us to do. And so what we indicate in our report is that this is a significant issue, an important issue. Everybody agrees it should be tackled. But we need a clear scope statement from the legislature if you would like more work to be done on this issue. And to give some examples of some of the things that we could look at further would be to review the goals and purposes of direct collateral consequences and whether the current consequences meet the goals or purposes sought to be achieved in enacting the collateral consequence. The two attorneys that you had that staff your committee talked about the different ways that collateral consequences have been enacted, and they've been enacted sometimes because of egregious cases or different things that have occurred throughout the years. And so a good task might be to go back and see whether or not the original purpose for establishing a collateral consequence is, in fact, being achieved. Whether all collateral consequences should be triggered at a common point, so in other words, at conviction versus charging, as I mentioned, in some of our collateral consequences occur as a result of the charge versus a conviction. So one thought would be, if the legislature would want us to come back with a recommendation on that, we could. Whether requiring that defendants be provided notice of collateral consequences prior to the plea and sentencing stages of criminal proceedings, and how that would impact the efficiency of the court system, reentry, how it would impact reentry or perhaps recidivism. Whether the ability of judges to suspend collateral consequences in individual cases would be a good idea, or how that would impact the efficiency of the courts, again, on reentry or recidivism. To examine the methods for relief from direct collateral consequences, and the prior speakers talked a little bit about that, perhaps issuing certificates of rehabilitation, looking at time limitations on collateral consequences, or non-imposition or suspension of consequences if the judiciary proposed that or allowed that in certain cases. We could also look at reviewing administrative consequences with special attention to driver's license reinstatement fees. That's an issue that comes up year after year. Also, one thing that we could do within the scope of the work would be to review review collateral consequences as they relate to immigration impacts, impacts on data harvesters. That issue was mentioned also by the previous speakers, employment and housing. Another idea that the committee came up with was to perhaps do a pilot study on the effect of notification and relief with respect to a limited number of consequences, look at the effect on the court system, look at the effect on offenders for rehabilitation and recidivism. The other area that we felt was lacking in our committee, the statute that was passed did define the membership of the committee. But what we realized when we were meeting as a group is that we were really missing some key people and stakeholders in this discussion, people such as the housing and employment, people that would represent, for instance, the housing and employment industries. Law enforcement did not serve on our committee, community crime prevention organizations, people of color, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, ex-offender groups. We didn't have representation from the Attorney General's office or those representing reentry services, and also we did not have members of the legislature that served on the committee. And so basically what we did was met for several months, tried to identify the extent of collateral consequences, did bring to light the fact that transparency certainly has been achieved by the revisor of statutes, creating a new chapter of law. But that if we were going to make meaningful recommendations, we would have to have a smaller scope and have some direction from the legislature as to what specifically you would like some recommendations about. And then, of course, along with that, the resources to conduct the work adequate to the scope of the work that the legislature would like to have done. We talked a lot in the committee about if the legislature decides to keep the Collateral Consequences Committee going, where would be the appropriate place. The consensus that we reached was that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission would be perhaps an appropriate place because it's outside of the executive branch of government, plays a more neutral role. And I did chat with Isabel Gomez, the director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and she indicated that given resources and staffing and scope and definition, that she certainly would be willing to entertain taking on that task.
Thank you. Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Allison? Senator Limmer.
Thank you. One of the groups that I personally believe is not represented on any of the lists so far are victims of crime. We don't seem to recognize in even previous testimony that I know there's groups, there's advocacy groups for victims of crime. Whether or not a court is considering expungement of records, I don't know if anyone is covered perhaps seeking the opinion of the victim of the crime when that's considered. And
Madam
Chair, I was
just
wondering if you could maybe tell me if that had been considered as well.
Commissioner Allison.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, crime victims is one of the categories that were listed for membership in the statute, and as I referenced, Lolita Uloa was the person that was selected to serve. She's director of the Crime Victim Assistance Program in Hennepin County.
I missed it.
If there are no more questions for Commissioner Allison, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name for the record is Bob Johnson, and I'm the Anoka County Attorney. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about a matter of very significant importance in our criminal justice system. I've been a prosecutor for over 35 years. I've had a wonderful opportunity to work statewide, nationally, and even internationally on criminal justice issues. I chaired, first of all, the committee of the National District Attorneys Association that created the National Prosecution Standards, and then spent 10 years on the ABA Criminal Justice Standards Committee that is a well-respected group producing criminal justice standards and has been for over 40 years. In the late 90s, 97, 98, I approached the chair of the Criminal Justice Council, which is the body that governs the criminal justice section of the American Bar Association. I've been involved with that group for some time, and suggested to him that I was tired of the council just dealing with the edges of things that were involved in the criminal justice system, and that we should focus on one of two matters that I suggested were very important things that were happening in the criminal justice system that we weren't paying attention to. I gave him those two subjects, and he said, "You're now chair of a committee to deal with collateral consequences." So he picked that one. I kept that committee because we didn't have a lot of resources either, kind of on life support, until about 2000, when I turned it over to Margaret Love, who is a tremendously energetic person. And we ended up creating criminal justice standards on collateral consequences that has a lot of proposals for how collateral consequences should be treated. I identified collateral consequences as a major movement in the criminal justice system for two reasons that I saw. It was, you know, understand that a prosecutor's job is to do justice. It's not just to convict. So we're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do in a particular situation. Some of the people that come before us, very much of a minority, are truly evil people. And it's easy then if we just try to max them, put them away for as long as we can. Most of the people that come into the system are not evil people. They've done something wrong. They need to be punished. And we have to do it in a way that's reasonable, that's justice. What I was seeing happen in the system was that to find justice, I had to take into consideration collateral consequences. And that twisted the way that I charged, and it twisted the way that I did plea bargaining. In fact, I'll leave it for you. I wrote a column on it as president of the National District Attorneys Association, suggesting that we had to take it into consideration. And that was troublesome for me, because in my charging decision and plea bargaining decision, and over the years I've done thousands and thousands and thousands of that, participated with prosecutors in my office, I wasn't able to target exactly what the person did necessarily, because if it was exactly what the person did, then it wasn't going to be a reasonable result. The 18-year-old who is having a sexual relationship with his 15-year-old girlfriend that he fully intends to marry, in my view, should not be registered as a sex offender. But if I charged him and convicted him of Crim Sex 3, which is what that is, he would be. There are times when the possession of a gun is important to the person's work, whether they're a reservist, a National Guard person, a police officer. And if they're convicted of a minor drug offense, they're barred. If they're convicted of domestic violence, they're for sure barred. In fact, I find it ironic that it's better to be convicted of a felony-level domestic violence than a misdemeanor, because the misdemeanor is forever under the federal law. because it says, the federal law says, when your rights are restored, then you can carry a gun. You don't lose your rights with a misdemeanor. So you have to be, if you're convicted of a felony, you get your rights back, and then you can carry a weapon. Not necessarily under state law, but just under federal law. There are a lot of little twists and turns in our criminal justice system that kind of make you wonder. There have been a number of times when I have seen people who committed criminal acts who were not held accountable because the judge felt that the collateral consequences of that was too severe. I had two people that I thought should get the collateral consequence. These were two people from Chechnya that stole over $100,000. And the judge, they pled guilty. Judge first tried to do a stay of adjudication. I said, no. I reversed her. Then tried to do a continuance for dismissal. I said, oh, no. So I reversed her on that. Had to appeal twice. Then she said, well, we're going to let them withdraw their plea and try it to the court. I can't in this state, and we're dealing with that at the County Attorney's Association, I can't demand a jury trial myself. Only the defense can do that. So they tried it to her, and guess what? She found them not guilty. So she won in the end. There are other examples like that. So I saw the collateral consequences twisting our system of justice, as I understood it, and I thought we should face up to it. Let's look at it. Let's figure out what's right. These are, after all, mandatory sentences, and they're for life in Minnesota under almost all the collateral consequences that we have. Now, when Senator Shadrach came to me and wanted my support to extend our gun prohibition, so for any of the 30-some crimes of violence in our statute, you would have a lifetime bar for possession of a firearm. I said I would do it only if he put an exception in. If we said in 609.165 that you can apply to the court and be relieved of that, would I support it? He agreed. It's now in statute. It's the only collateral consequence I know that's less than lifetime. So these bars are there forever. Largely, a lot of them are employment bars. Well, around 2000, the Attorney General, first Attorney General Reno, and then Attorney General Ashcroft, one of the, I would suggest, very few things that they might have agreed upon, was that reentry was important. Moving people from prison and jail back into society so that they could become productive members of society. And that if we weren't able to accomplish that, it was going to be dangerous to public safety. Can't find a job, can't find a place to live, guess what you're going to be doing. That issue was taken up by the Council of State Governments in an excellent piece of work that some of you I know have seen. I know Senator Foley has. This little document, report of the Reentry Policy Council. And in that, they take up collateral consequences to a degree. It's not a major focus of it, but it's certainly a part of it. So in my mind, that added an additional reason to deal with collateral consequences, to face up to it, say, what are they? Are they appropriate? Should they be forever? How can you provide relief from collateral consequences? I've had county attorneys, frankly, our current president of our County Attorneys Association once said to me that he had a hard time with regard to the pheasant hunters out in the middle of Minnesota. They were coming in for expungements. Because they wanted to be able to carry a gun, pheasant hunting. So we were getting expungements. Police officers were coming in and getting expungements of their old domestic violence convictions. And we lost the conviction. We didn't lose what would have been okay for me to say, okay, you can carry your gun. I would have gladly surrendered that. But we were losing the whole conviction because of a collateral consequence. My point in going through all of this is that in my mind, collateral consequences are a big deal. They're a big deal because they mess up the work that I do, the work that judges do, and as has been recognized around the country, collateral consequences may be, if they're not handled appropriately, a tremendous impediment to people coming back and being productive members of our society. So I urge you folks, the legislature, to continue this effort, perhaps merge these groups, but focus us on how to deal with this in a smart way. I mean, there are clearly some collateral consequences that are appropriate, and let's have those continue on. There are some that have nothing at all to do with the conviction that aren't appropriate. Let's figure out a way to deal with those. And if you give us enough time, I'm hopeful we can come together on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are you aware in the work that you do of how other states are addressing this issue, and are there best practices or are there models out there that perhaps we could take a look at?
Madam Chair, there are a number of them. Margaret Love, this energetic woman that I mentioned, has put together a 50-state analysis of a lot of this. It's not as comprehensive as it could be, but it certainly addresses some of it, and states are dealing with this. It's the fascinating thing about our system of justice, because it's so decentralized. There's over 2,500 different prosecution offices, elected prosecution offices, each one their own little kingdom of how to do things. And they all have programs, and there are 50 different states doing things 50 different ways, and that is a fertile area for exploration.
So, Mr. Johnson, perhaps that could be one of the scope if we were looking for some way to maybe help the group continue to do its work. Do you have any recommendations on maybe how to scope it to best get maybe a product or an end result that we can look at?
Well, it depends in part on how many resources you're able to put towards this work. The fewer the resources, the more limited the scope. There's good work that can be done even on a limited basis, though. So I don't mean to put you off by that. This is such an enormous undertaking because it gets into this reentry issue that's also being worked on in our state and other states. I know Joan Fabian has tasked a group to be working on that in her area. And I know that Mary Alaros had some thoughts. What was it you were mentioning originally about the scope of it that we might take up? I've passed through my mind.
Commissioner Allison?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a couple things I would want to just point to is, one is the fact that our revisor of statutes sits on a national group to look at the different ways that different states have addressed this issue and come up with model legislation. That certainly would be something that the legislature could take a look at. Also, I think the work that Margaret Love has done, looking at how different states are addressing this issue, would be very significant. It occurred to me when I was listening to the testimony of the individuals that testified before us, the work that the data policy group is doing, that to simply even take on the whole background check and expungement issue would be a huge step forward. So even something where you considered the next phase of the work that the background and expungement working groups of the data policy group is going to do, along with looking at the work that this NCLUSL, the National Commissioners of Revisers of Statutes, is going to develop or is developing, and also the Margaret Love work that she's developing, those two things together could be a way to move forward.
And
thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to
Mr.
work
Johnson.
With whoever else you might have working on a scoping issue. I also worked with the NCLUSL group, which actually grew out of the ABA work. We had a member of NCLUSL who was our representative from the Board of Governors. So I'd be happy to work on that.
Thank you. Any further questions for Commissioner Ellison or Mr. Johnson on the collateral consequences report? Members, I have here a memo, and I will make it available to all of you. A list of about, I think for now, as dated August of 2006, I believe a list of about 18 occupations
that are prohibited to persons convicted of felony. We will make sure we get that copy and get it to all the members.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I was thinking about that list as people were talking, it has some interesting things in it. It seemed like there was a point at which people started saying that list started saying rather than all felonies, it was like felonies related to the business that they were in. And then there's this huge human services long paragraph about the collateral consequences in the jobs there. And it seems to me that there might be appropriate times when if the incident related to, if you were a, what's one of the things on there, investment banker or something, if your crime was something related to investment banking, it probably is reasonable to think that you maybe shouldn't be an investment banker again. But maybe not some of those other things that are on the list. And so I think we have a lot of work to do in this issue. And I'm really thankful that everybody has put in 9 months of work on this already. And I look forward to seeing what the task force comes up with.
Members, on the issue of collateral consequences, I would like to get some direction from this committee to see where your thoughts are. What I heard is that there is both a need and a desire to continue to do the work with a narrowing of the scope, and there is potentially we need to invest some resources into this. We have an opportunity to do that, and as we're going to continue this committee on Thursday, if there is a desire on the part of this committee to do something about this area, I would like to work with Mr. Anderson and Commissioner Ellison to come up with maybe an amendment to some kind of to one of the bills that we're working with to perhaps help to direct the work of this committee, of this task force. But I guess I'd like to have a discussion among the members so that I can know how to proceed. Well, then I will just do exactly what I want to do on this.
Wanted it now.
Oh, it usually works. Yeah.
Oh. Well, maybe it is unusual. I am actually soliciting participation from the members, and the senior members are all puzzled why I'm soliciting input. And yeah. I shall just dictate what we will do on Thursday. All right. Thank you for your input.
It was all very wise.
I want to thank the members of that task force. They did a lot of work. With very little resources, and I deeply appreciate the individuals who are willing to invest their talent and their time into the task force. Your work was not in vain. This chair feels very strongly that we ought to move in the direction, even though the committee didn't give input. I think their silence indicate that we can move on that. And so I'm going to work with Commissioner Ellison and perhaps Mr. Johnson and anyone else who's interested to try to come up with something for the committee to consider on Thursday with respect to collateral consequences. We have, a number of people. Senator Foley, did you have a comment you wanted to make?
Well, Madam Chair, I am pleased with the direction you're going. I think that I've been involved with the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Task Force that originated this program, and what it needs now is, I think, through an expanded staff, an opportunity to move forward with this and look at. I think all of us have some concerns about various aspects of expungement and so forth that we'll have to work out in smaller groups than this. So thank you for your willingness to take this on, because it's a question of continuing what we already are doing and expanding on it.
Thank you. we have some a couple of people who have indicated that they want to testify today. Can I see a show of hands who needs to testify today? Mr. Neumeister? Okay, we have some individuals who will not be here on Thursday. I was hoping to get to one of the bills, but I think it's okay. It's important to get the public testimony, and then we'll get to the three bills. Members, there's a good chance that in order to get through the entire agenda on Thursday, that we will go beyond 6 o'clock. We'll go till the bills are finished, but I'm giving you fair warning right now that we will go late on Thursday. All right. Well, why don't we you can all decide who will come, but we'll start with Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I just put up this little placard. All the meetings I go to, they call me a privacy advocate, so I thought I'd put that up for the heck of it, just for a laugh. Madam Chair, my name is Rich Neumeister. I've been on the task force that Senator Foley mentioned since its inception, 1993. I'm going to take the presumption. I'm going to talk about your bills because you're probably aware at least some of the bills that are before you today. First of all, I want to start out with Senate File 279 and what I oppose and what I think can make some good suggestions if you're going to deal with the bill. On page, basically, sections 1 through sections 6, I do oppose. I oppose automatic sealing of expungement of records, automatic expungement of records. Now, if you go into the report that was handed to you, you will see minority reports. And I have a minority report in there and my rationale why I oppose, and also Mark Anvinson and some other people who did reports. You can see that. So I'm not going to take the time to explain that. It's there. Now, on section 5, I do have some questions about it. I also oppose that. I like the standards that we now have in 609, how records are sealed and unsealed, and that's already in law. The effect of sealing, though, section 6, I think that's a very important one to consider. I gave to Ms. Pontius, who's your Senate counsel, some of the tables from Margaret Colgate Love's report. It's also what other states do with expungement and set-asides and all that. And also, in that report, there's another survey I gave to her for your perusal, what they do with discriminatory practices about arrest records, expungement records, those kinds of things. This is a big thing in states. A lot of states have done this. Wisconsin, California, go on and on and on. So I think that's an important part to have in a bill. Now, the other one on page 4, section 9, I agree that if there's anything that comes out of this session, because we've been dealing with this issue for at least 2 years, the bottom line is there is already an expungement law. We know that people are getting expungements and then are getting hooked by the private sector who still have the data. So I think that's something that can be done this year and worked about. What Ms. Senator Moore has on Section 9 is one I can agree with, but I agree with one that will be before you on Thursday, Senator Betzelt's one. And basically they're pretty much the same, except what he does, he put in his bill, is that the people that are the givers of this data, i.e., whether it be BCA, local agencies, they have to sign a contract. Texas has something like that. I gave copies of that to Ms. Pontius. Texas is the first state in the union that has tried to do it with some type of understanding or contract. In 2003, they did it. They also did amendments in 2005. The bottom line is, if it's used, they lose access to some of the records or whatever. So there's a panoply of things you can do. But I like Senator Betzelt's approach with an agreement, except in 914, what you do not have is the courts, because the courts are basically where the people go to get all the arrest data, the conviction data, and all that. You've got to remember, BCA does not give out arrest records because it's considered private. Remember, only thing that's public at BCA are conviction records, up and they decay after 15 years from when one is off paper. So if you're going to proceed on a bill, sort of like what a 914 is, or on Section 9 is, or Senator Ortman has dealing with business screening services, you got to include the courts, or some discussion how to include all that pile of data that they got. And secondly, make sure you have that contract in there. And then finally, another approach to this, and I'll also give this to Ms. Pontius, is a number of states have taken what the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and which is basically what is in Ortman's bill, which is in Betzelt's bill 914, and also what's in 279. Now the thing is that what California has done and some other states, they have said in employment background checks, if you're going to use employment background checks of public records, 30 days before that, you get a report, before that report is sent, you got to make sure that it is accurate. Now, that's in the eye of the beholder, but one of the things that they are trying to prevent is if you cannot verify it on a public record, Neumeister was arrested 15 years ago, it was a resolve in my favor, it was because I was a pain in the rear to somebody or whatever, I'm arrested. I get it expunged from the public record, it's no longer there. So it puts a burden on the background checks that do it for employment only, that they have to, 30 days before it's out, from my understanding, that has to be verified. If it's not there, then it wouldn't be there. There's always going to be these reports. People are going to get information somehow. But the great many who do employment checks do it by traditionally standard companies, those kinds of things like that. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, those are my points. I do have some concerns about expungement. Again, the minority reports, there was a lot. I dissented on a number of those kinds of things. I think the system is pretty good now. Find some solution to Schultz, and that's where the approach by Senator Betzelt is kind of interesting. But one of the things, if you go that way, I want to make sure that if you do this inherent authority, that the police, the victim, the prosecutors, and all those are informed, like what you do for current statutory scheme. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to give this some information to Ms. Pontius. So if you're interested, what I've talked to, she would have that. And I come a long ways as Senator Betzelt and Phil Carruthers, Speaker Carruthers would tell you, I was one of the main proponents against this bill back in 96 when 609 became law. And there were some good compromises at that time of expungement, but we have seen things have changed since then. So I think it's great that you folks are looking at that. And if you're going to do this collateral consequence committee, it's important to have just regular folks on there who know about privacy and some of those kinds of things too. So if you're going to expand the group and put some of these things in there to do background and all that, so you can make sure you come back with a good product. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions for him? Very good. Thank you very much. is it Ms. Lynn Torgerson? Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Lynn Torgerson.
You can sit down.
Torgerson. Good afternoon. I'm a criminal defense lawyer in Minneapolis, and as such, I regularly litigate expungement petitions on behalf of petitioners. and given kind of what's been going on, I think, in the courts lately, I tend to have a strong interest in this area on behalf of my clients. I just found out about this yesterday, and I've never appeared before a body like this, so I'll do the best I can.
Ms. Torgerson, we can't be any worse than some of the judges you've had to appear in front of. So,
all right.
At least
I won't comment on that.
Some of the members will try. Whatever you've heard about us, it's all true, but it's just perception.
All right. Thank you. I've had a chance to take a look at Bill number 685, and I think it's a great amendment to the statutes. There has been, I think, extensive litigation in the courts right now as to the extent of the court's authority, as to whether they can expunge executive branch records. I think this is a very important amendment. The definition of expungement has traditionally been to erase all evidence of the event as if it never occurred. And it's supposed to accomplish a meaningful remedy. So it's very important that they be able to expunge all the records. I also did want to address that under the current state of the law, under the 609A, which the legislature enacted in 1996, it doesn't provide, under the statute, there's no authority to grant expungement where a person has been convicted of an offense ever. And I think it's really important that at some point that we do have the statute amended to allow for expungements where there has been a conviction. I just had a case recently. I represented a former college student. It was a woman or young gal going to school up north in Bemidji. And wrongly, she had extended her parking permit a few days. Apparently, you have to pay to park and by the dormitory or what have you, and she didn't have the money, and she changed her parking permit and extended a few days and was caught. So the amount of the potential theft was, you know, probably $10 or something like this. It's been several years since that conviction. She went to court, was convicted of a misdemeanor theft conviction, which typically prohibits a person from working at numerous positions, banks and, you know, other employers. And we tried to get an expungement, and the expungement was, it's been a few years. I can't remember exactly how many. It hasn't been it hasn't been 10 years for sure. But she tried to get an expungement, and that was denied. So, and then the courts currently are saying that under Schultz and TMB that they don't have the authority to expunge any records following a conviction. So the current state of the law is that if somebody has ever been convicted of any crime, that they can never get an expungement ever. And I did also want to mention that under the current statute, under Chapter 609A, there is an excellent balancing test that both the inherent authority the courts has been using and now has been in the statute for several years, where there's a balancing test which the courts engage in, which I think is a more than sufficient test. The courts are not, expunging murder convictions or, you know, sexual assault convictions or anything like that. I think the courts, you know, have had the discretion and have done a good job of employing this balancing test. And I think that the balancing test is adequate, and that the law in that respect is adequate as it is now, and that a lot of the restrictions that were brought up earlier today, I think, proposed by or presented by Mr. Holmgren, tend to unduly restrict the ability of the courts to engage in this, the discretion they need in appropriate cases. Currently, they have to, you know, under the 609A, they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that getting an expungement benefits the petitioner more than it harms the public interest. I do know of cases, that you know, where a person has been convicted, for example, of misdemeanor domestic assault, where probably they should obtain an expungement, and under the proposals in these materials, they want to just put an absolute bar on that forever. And I also don't think that the time limits, the waiting periods are appropriate. I think it should just be left, the balancing test in the statute should be left as it is and not impose numerous additional restrictions, which is essentially eliminate the relief obtained by an expungement. And I think that's all I wanted to say today. And thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Torgerson. Now, that wasn't bad, right?
No,
does anybody have a question for her to change her mind about her? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your time. Let's see. Mr. Michael Friedman?
Hi. Thank you, everybody. My name is Michael Friedman. I'm the executive director of the Legal Rights Center. Probably several of you are familiar with the organization, but probably not with me, as I've only been in that position for about 1 year. I'm testifying today because I cannot be here Thursday. I'm going to be at the Urban League at an all-day conference that they're putting on to discuss the crisis of violence on the North Side, the crisis within the African-American community related to both imprisonment and reentry issues, as well as juvenile crime. I have a special interest in expungement issues and personally have given expungement information workshops along with Julie Lechner, is it your last name? Sorry, of the BCA at HIRED, which is a Northside workforce center. And one of the things that I think is important to understand about the CRIMNET report that we heard from earlier is that I felt that the perspective of the people that I am seeing at HIRED, both in terms of the people who are applying and the workforce counselors who are trying to get people into jobs, that perspective is missing from the constituency of the CRIMNET report. If you look carefully at the names, virtually everybody on the list thinks of the subject of the data relative to the point of time when they are being charged with a crime. So their vision of the person that we're talking about is right at the point where there is some kind of troubled situation that's being addressed. What's missing from the people on that committee is a perspective the years afterward where they see them at an older age, at an older perspective, and understanding what their perspective is at that time. I'm just going to divert for a second just because of my knowledge of the expungement issues. The Senate counsel that commented on Bill 279 had in his report to you has something that's incomplete and maybe misleading relating to 299C expungements. 299C expungements have almost the opposite problem of Schultz in the sense that they are binding on the executive branch but not necessarily on the courts. So, for instance, if someone is arrested and brought to court and a court record is created, but then the case is dismissed before probable cause is found, the 299C letter, which looks like a simple process, might get back all their police department and, if applicable, BCA records. But the court record will still be there for a data harvester to find. And so those people actually have to do petitions. It's very unusual for someone to do 299C separate from having to do that 609, which is why automatic sealing when there is a very quick and early dismissal of a case is very much relevant, if for no other reason, the burden on the court's time, which is something that hasn't been brought up. But I think if you investigated, would hear that the courts, at least in the metro area, are very much inundated with expungement petitions, and I think they might appreciate some kind of automatic process when that's obvious. Finally, just to relate it back to the fact that I am going to the Urban League on Thursday, I do want to, and I know Tom Johnson on Thursday is going to say this a lot better than I can, but I want to remove what I think is a presumption that's being generated in a lot of the discussion, which is that knowledge of a criminal record equals public safety. It's almost been taken as a matter of intuitive truth that if you know that there's someone who has a criminal record and that information is available to the public, that public safety is being served. Well, I think I don't mean to pick on the north side of Minneapolis, but Council on Crime and Justice records and other information, DOC information, would show how many people on the north side of Minneapolis have criminal records. And it would show that the neighbors maybe are in position to know, they're informed, that there are people in their proximity with criminal records. But that doesn't necessarily equal safety. What brings safety is the economic well-being of having steady employment and having steady housing. And I think that I urge the committee not to just accept it as a matter of fiat or obvious intuition, logic, whatever, that having knowledge of a convicted record somehow serves the interests of the public, because I will argue that that is a debatable contention. Thank you.
Mr. Freeman, first of all, you should leave here tonight with the comfort that in this committee, this issue would not be receiving so much depth of discussion and consideration if that were true. And the reason why we're delving into this area is that there's a consensus among those of us in this committee and those at large that there is some value to giving people employment and give them a life, because I think we see a value beyond that. So I don't want you to leave here thinking that we're operating under that misperception. I would like you to leave thinking that we do have good intentions and we do want to try to address the economic development, the jobs, the housing issues that ultimately you are concerned about. The other area, too, is that, and Ms. Neumeister suggested this, too, that just because certain individuals may be absent from the composition of who is doing the work, I think that there's still some good and valid recommendations and policy work that have been done on the part of those task forces. So, if there's some concern about areas or recommendations that are inaccurate or not good, I would like to hear that from you. But I think overall, even though there wasn't an opportunity to be comprehensive in who participated in these task forces, I feel that they've done good work and they've come back to us with some thoughtful recommendations that this committee will take into consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do recognize that by the very questions that were asked of the presenters, I am going to go away with a very good feeling about the interests and concerns of this committee. And maybe one of the things that I should have just specified before I closed is that I'm really here to speak in support of your own bill, 279, and I think that adequately addresses the community concerns that are brought to me on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. Let us know how the conference goes. We have an interest in the result of that conference.
Okay, I will be back.
Senator Betzel, did you have a question? No. Senator Higgins? All right. Thank you. Anybody else in the audience who are not going to be here? Are you not going to be here on Thursday?
I'll be here. Thank you,
Madam. Okay. So we have about 5 minutes left. Please come to the table to testify. This is for members of the public who are not going to be able here to be here on Thursday. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. That's my other life. I'm here today as the president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. And I'm here largely because of the report that you heard earlier on background checks. And I'd just like to point out three or four things I hopefully will be gone in 60 seconds. The first one is that we have had background checks for the acquisition or carry of firearms since 1973. Fingerprints have never been required during that entire period of time. Under the proposal that was distributed here, we would have a quarter of a million or more completely law-abiding people who are acquiring firearms or carry permits fingerprinted every year. And thirdly, the FBI, under the Brady Bill, manages to conduct the National Instant Criminal Background Check System for firearms at no expense to states. They do it without fingerprints. They do it on 30 million people a year. And they do it extraordinarily effectively. And once again, as I said, at no charge to the states. Minnesota uses that as part of our background check system. So fingerprints of people applying for permits to acquire firearms or for permits to carry firearms are simply not required. By the evidence of 30-plus years of experience in Minnesota and, of course, the conduct of the FBI in conducting the checks under the Brady Bill. I have some handouts that describe what takes place at the FBI with regard to those checks for the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Olson. Thanks for coming in. Anybody have a question for the professor? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to raise the issue that I don't think you're at all correct when you talk about the need for the fingerprints or other biometric measurements that you cannot recognize everyone that goes through the process and guarantee that the person is the person that they say they are and therefore are obtaining a gun permit in this case, but could be a variety of other issues, that it's clearly necessary to have access to that data. That's one of the reasons why the state BCA has a suspense file that has a whole bunch of applications in there, or a crime, whatever the thing relates to, and it isn't, they can't file those without having the fingerprints or some other biometric measurement.
Professor Olson, did you want to respond?
Madam Chairman, Senator, it simply is the case that the NICS checks are conducted by the FBI without fingerprints.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Olson, you make reference to the possibility of having a quarter million people filed under fingerprinting if they're a gun owner. Are you making reference to a specific bill that's before us on that?
No, I'm not. That was a part of the presentation that you were given on background checks and expungement. And it's in the materials that you were handed out, and I just wanted to make sure that people understood that if you go into the background check issue, you will run into this issue as well.
All right.
Very good.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Mr. Holmgren, I got a question from somebody who wondered if you could respond to this. It sounded from your work and your recommendation that there wasn't any discussion about implementation. Can you talk a little bit about that? Did that come up as an issue in some of the areas that you talked about or some of the recommendations?
I don't completely understand your question about implementation. In what sense?
In sense of the five or so recommendations that you made, did the group leap to the next level of looking at or discussing what the impact would be to actually implement some of those recommendations and maybe any kind of costs that are associated with them?
Madam Chair and members, we did not address that issue specifically. We did, in fact, review these recommendations with the full task force. And I know, for example, that some of the court members were concerned about costs of implementation. Because we were interested in getting this report off to the policy group for their consideration. We had a felt we had a deadline to do that because of potential bills, that type of thing. We did not discuss that, but rather left that to the individual agencies to raise during the discussion. So we anticipate, for example, that the courts may have some interest in automatic expungements if it affects them fiscally, and that they would come to do that. Yeah, and I've just been advised that the policy group is also going to be looking at fiscal issues when they study this further in May, as I understand it.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and we'll continue this on Thursday. Committee's adjourned. Got you out of here.